You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Aaron Mankey's Cabinet of Curiosities, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild.
Our world is full of the unexplainable. And if history is an open book, all of these amazing tales are right there on display, just waiting for us to explore. Welcome to the Cabinet of Curiosities. Ah, Paris, the city of light, the city of love, and the city of unnecessary challenges of violence in the name of romance. That's what it was like in France in the 18th and 19th centuries. In those days, if someone offended you, or you were competing for the love of a particular woman, you could challenge the other person to a duel. Before the late 18th century, swords were the weapon of choice. In 1841's The History of Dueling, the author outlined dozens of rules to be followed for a successful duel. For example, Rule 43 dictated what moves a fighter could make with a sword, stating, "Combatants are allowed to raise themselves, to stoop, to vault to the right or to the left, and to turn around each other." Rule 44 allowed combat to stop if one party declared themselves wounded, or if one of the witnesses noticed that someone had been hurt. And just how common was it? Well, King Louis XIII pardoned more than 8,000 people for committing murder during a duel. So, yeah, a lot. Pistols only made the practice more deadly, too. A puncture or a cut from a blade was not necessarily a death sentence back then, but a bullet in a crucial part of the body could be the end of someone immediately, or worse, days later. Alexander Hamilton famously died 31 hours after being shot by Aaron Burr in 1804. Dueling was an act that was both barbaric and pointless, yet some people saw no other way to settle their differences, especially two Frenchmen in the early 19th century who really escalated the situation. Their duel took place only 4 years after Hamilton's fateful trip to Weehawken, New Jersey. A young dancer with the Paris Opera known as Mademoiselle Tirivette had been in a relationship with one Monsieur du Grand Pré. It seemed like things were going pretty well for them, but it seems that she was also seeing Monsieur Lepic on the side. So when Grand Pré found out that he was not the only person in his beloved's life, he did what all men in his situation did in 1808 France. He challenged the other man to a duel. Of course, these were macho, testosterone-fueled gents who refused to settle for a standoff with pistols in the middle of a field. No, in order to win the heart and hand of Mademoiselle Tirivette, they needed to face off in a spectacular way, high above the ground, in hot air balloons. They met on May 3rd, still in the middle of a field, mind you, but on this occasion they stood by as two large balloons were heated up and inflated. Each man had also brought a second, a witness to be responsible for making sure that the duel was carried out as expected. Now, in a normal duel, the second would walk away afterward and go home to their families. In this instance, however, each second had resigned himself to dying in the event the other balloon's occupants succeeded, because the goal here was not for the duelers to shoot one another. Grand Prix and Lepic, each man armed with a blunderbuss, would fly high into the air with their seconds and fire at their opponent's balloon. Whoever managed to pop the other man's balloon would receive Mademoiselle Tirivette's hand. The other? Well, he and his second would plummet to their deaths below. A large crowd gathered on the morning of the event, excited to watch four grown men get into a couple of hot air balloons and shoot each other down rather than talk through their feelings like adults. They climbed inside, and each balloon began to rise. Up, up, up they went to a half mile over the crowd. When they reached the appropriate height, both men got into position. Lepic shot first. He fired wide and missed Grand Prix's balloon entirely. Grand Prix returned fire, and it was a success. he managed to shoot a hole in Lapique's balloon, sending it careening into a terrace below. Lapique and his second were killed instantly in the crash, while Grand Prix climbed even higher in triumph before floating down gently to the woman below that he loved. The whole ordeal was over quickly, but it left a lasting impression on dueling history, and it reminds us today of that age-old cliche. What goes up must come down.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
With AT&T in-car Wi-Fi, stay connected wherever you go and transform your vehicle into a dependable Wi-Fi hotspot. Powering applications like real-time GPS and voice assistant, navigation becomes a breeze. Even on the practice field, AT&T in-car Wi-Fi keeps you connected while in proximity of your vehicle. Work, stream shows, or finish homework without missing a beat. See if you're eligible for a free trial at att.com/in-car Wi-Fi. Don't let connectivity be a roadblock in your journey. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use when vehicle is in operation, compatible device and vehicle required.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Historians and scholars have spent decades working with the world's most mysterious documents and artifacts. For example, there's the Voynich Manuscript, an illustrated codex written during the 15th century in an unknown language. It first showed up in 1912 and was believed to have been decoded as recently as 2017. However, those translations were quickly debunked, and so the manuscript is still considered uncracked. Then there's also the Shugborough Inscription, a 10-letter sequence carved into a monument in England. And although the inscription has existed since the mid-1700s, we are no closer to understanding its meaning than we were 2.5 centuries ago. But one particular historical object didn't require extensive study to understand. In fact, researchers seemed to have figured out exactly what it was pretty quickly, or so they thought. It was called the Shapira Scroll, named for the man who revealed it to the world, Moses Wilhelm Shapira. He was born in 1830 in what is now Ukraine, and worked as an antiques dealer in Jerusalem. Shapira first brought the scroll to Paul Schroeder, a German scholar and interpreter who specialized in Semitic languages. Schroeder asked about its origins, to which Shapira replied that it had been discovered in a cave near the Dead Sea. However, when University of Berlin professor Hermann Streck asked Shapira about the scroll's provenance, he was told a fantastical story about how a group of people had accidentally found them rolled up in a bundle of rugs in a mountain cave. In fact, depending on who he was talking to, Shapira told a different story. So, what was the scroll he found? Well, it wasn't really a scroll at all, in that it wasn't a long roll of paper. Instead, the Shapira scroll was comprised of 15 separate strips of leather, each with a modified Bible verse from the book of Deuteronomy written across them. What's more, the language written on each of the strips was Paleo-Hebrew, an older version of the Hebrew language found on stone walls and tablets beginning in the 13th century BCE. According to Shapira, his fragments had been created before the fall of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. In other words, they were the oldest known biblical documentation in existence. He sent facsimiles of the strips all over Germany to have them authenticated. Historians, scholars, and librarians studied them closely. The Royal Library of Berlin wanted to purchase the originals so that they could be examined by German students. But Shapira had no interest in having his scroll put under the microscope for handfuls of students to study. Instead, he suggested that the British Museum buy the whole collection for £1 million. The public was enthralled and flocked to the museum to see two of the scrolls in person. A Bible scholar named Christian David Ginsburg took possession of the remaining fragments to analyze them. It took him a month, but when he was done, Ginsburg came to a very important conclusion. They were forgeries. Now, Shapira wasn't a stranger to fake documents and antiquities. In 1870, he had tried fooling buyers with fabricated artifacts from the ancient Moabite culture. Why anyone entertained his latest attempt was a mystery, but many did, especially the public, who were captivated by the existence of the strips. According to Ginsburg, it appeared that Shapira had cut up a Yemenite Torah scroll. These scrolls were very old, possibly hundreds of years, and quite valuable. Shapira had sold Yemenite scrolls to the British Museum before, and it was believed that he had cut strips from the empty bottom margin to create his own biblical relics. Of course, Shapira wrote a letter to Ginsburg in which he declared his innocence in the whole ordeal. He believed the scroll was authentic, but claimed that if it was fake, someone else had been responsible for its creation and had duped him. Shapira then traveled to Amsterdam, where he sent another letter, this time to Edward Augustus Bond. Bond was the primary librarian for the British Museum, and Shapira begged him to check the scrolls again. Sadly, he never got his answer. 6 months later, he took his own life. The Shapira scrolls went up for auction a few years afterward, selling for a measly £10. After 1889, no one saw them again. Interest in the artifacts all but disappeared. Until the mid-1900s. Between 1947 and 1956, the first seven Dead Sea Scrolls were found in caves alongside the Dead Sea, discoveries that seemed eerily similar to what Moses Shapira used to say about his leather fragments. Scholars to this day are divided on the true provenance of the Shapira scroll, with some claiming that it could have been legitimate, while others maintain the original conclusion that the scroll was a forgery. Moses Shapira might have been responsible for one of the greatest historical discoveries ever recorded, but his previous deceptions had ruined his chances for success. Heartbreaking for sure, but also, oh so curious. I hope you've enjoyed today's guided tour of the Cabinet of Curiosities. Subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or learn more about the show by visiting curiositiespodcast.com. This show was created by me, Aaron Mankey, in partnership with How Stuff Works. I make another award-winning show called Lore, which is a podcast, book series, and television show, and you can learn all about it over at theworldoflore.com. And until next time, stay curious. Thank you.